I think the board underestimated how badly Mr. Luthi wanted to get it done and what he was willing to pay to get it done. And all of a sudden it was done. There are some very interesting sidelights along the way. Somewhere, I've forgotten exactly where, in the spring or maybe early summer of 1971, when the whole merger thing was moving up toward a climax in the legislature, I had never met Arthur de Bartoleben, the one-time president of the Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin, and previous member of the board, but not member of the board at the time, but in 1971. But a man that I had heard a great deal about, and heard a great deal about his very loyal and dedicated interest to the University of Wisconsin here at Madison, and a well-known Democrat in the state, indeed a man who had been reasonably active in Mr. Luthi's campaign. And I wanted to meet Mr. de Bartoleben, and I wanted to get his point of view on find out where he stood on merger and what his position about it was. And I called Mr. de Bartoleben one day up at his office in Park Falls, not having met him and not knowing him at all, except by reputation. And I just indicated to him that I was deeply concerned about the merger matter, and that I really would value knowing that he'd been a very dedicated friend of the university here at Madison. I'd like very much to have a chance to discuss the matter with him. And was there any possibility of his being in Madison in the next week or so? And if there were, would he be willing to spend a little time with me? He responded very quickly and very immediately and said, I am very much interested in the matter. And he said, I am very much opposed to a merger. And he said, I'd be very pleased to discuss the matter with you. And he said, I'll drive to Madison tomorrow if you want me to. He did, and he and I had about a two-hour conversation, which was a very interesting one. I can remember very well Mr. de Bartoleben saying that he had written Mr. Luthi's campaign speeches that dealt with education, and he said for the campaign. And he said, to his knowledge, Mr. Luthi had never considered the matter of merger for the election. He said, we had it in none of his speeches. He said, I didn't have any notion that he had this on his mind at all, if indeed he did before the election. And I'm very much surprised by his position, and I'm very much opposed to it. And he indicated his willingness to be of any help he could in an effort to block the merger from taking place. I can only speculate about what relationship this had to Mr. de Bartoleben's ultimate conversations with and relationships with the governor. But it's an interesting thing that it was only some years after merger, two or three years after merger, Mr. Lucy appointed Mr. Duvardleben to the newly merged board. Obviously, whatever rancor there may have been there over that merger issue was somehow resolved. I guess that the fact is that long about October, whenever it was that, whatever date it was that merger actually passed the Senate, and we all recognized the fact that merger had occurred. It would have been easy to have been sufficiently disenchanted at that point to have said, all right, incidentally, I should have mentioned that one of Mr. Lucy's early ploys in the merger matter, as the record will show, was that quite early on in the effort to, in his campaign to promote merger, he had identified me as his choice of the person that should be in charge of the merged system once it was established. I assume this was a political maneuver to seek to neutralize my negative attitudes toward merger and to put me in a position of finding it difficult to oppose merger because who, as he saw it, was going to fail to be happy to accept the bigger accolade of being president of all of public higher education in Wisconsin. It would be hard for me to reconcile the fact that he nominated me so readily and so quickly for the position because he was so happy with me as it being a president of the whole system because he had taken such immediate and clear umbrage about my appointment in the first place. I'm sure it was politically astute on his part to seek to neutralize my negative attitudes by having me identified right off the beginning as the one that would be his choice for being president of the merged system. I can only say that it didn't have that effect on me. Indeed, when merger finally took place, it would have been very easy for me, and the thought crossed my mind more than once that perhaps really what I should do is simply indicate that clearly I was not brought to Wisconsin to be president of the merged system. I'd been brought to be president of the University of Wisconsin, and that if the whole ball game was now to stand in this completely changed manner, that the new Board of Regents, once it got itself organized, probably should be free to go in search of a new president for a completely different and new kind of a position. And indeed, I made it clear to many members of my board and subsequently to some members of the State University Board as I got to know them that I was uneasy about whether or not I should seek to continue as president of the newly merged system.
One rumor had it that you would threaten to resign if merger went through.
No, I never made that threat. I never made it to anyone personally or to, I never reached such a conclusion in my own mind. I say it was tempting to consider it because certainly this was not a job I had come to the state to do. And it certainly was not a job I had sought, nor that I even felt was was desirable. But on reflection and with strong encouragement from a number of the regents, I began to turn my thoughts more to the fact that, well, after all, the people of the state have through their legislature at least, voted that this is the way it is to be. And what's needed is some dedicated service to whether it's a good idea or whether it's not a good idea, is that somehow it's got to work. It's got to be made to work, because the stakes are so terribly important. And we can't let this be a case of the University of Wisconsin or any other part of higher education in the state coming into serious disrepair. It's got to be taken hold of, and for the sake of everyone concerned, it's got to be made one way or another to work, if it can be made to work. And so I guess as the board and the newly combined board and I began to face up to the reality of where we were, and they came together for their first meeting when they unanimously asked me to take on the presidency of the, be the first president of this new system. I indicated I would, and indicated in the speech I made to them at the time, it's a matter of record, that I would do my very best to help the all of the various factions to come together and to see if indeed we couldn't make this thing work in the interests of everyone concerned.
Did you have any serious reservations about the possibility that it might not work?
Well, I think that possibility always hung over our heads. Although I never, I guess, when I accepted the job, I accepted it in the belief that we couldn't fall prey to the belief it wouldn't work, because, or to the thought that it wouldn't work, because it had to work. We had it. Merger was a fact. And here were 140,000 students and 25,000 faculty members and a lot of universities with a lot of very important missions, and we couldn't let it fail. It just was too important that it succeed, and some way we had to find the way it could succeed. There were a lot of things about those early days that were very highly tension-ridden.
What was the mood of that first board
meeting? The mood of that first board meeting was one of a pretty high level of tension. The two boards were anything less than confident of one another, and there were lots of suspicions in both directions about how maneuvering was going to commence to try to get one group, maneuvering that would permit one group to get an advantage over the other. Just in the matter of the election of officers of the new board, you were confronted with the problem.
Could you explain that a bit?
Well, who was going to be the new president of this board? Was it going to be a member of the president? Was it going to be the man who was at the time the president of the University of Wisconsin board, namely Bernie Ziegler, or was it going to be Roy Kopp, who was at that time the president of the state university board?
Well, we know who it was, but how did it get resolved?
Well, it got resolved because there were gentlemen involved. Roy Kopp is a consummate gentleman, and so is Bernie Ziegler. And Bernie Ziegler simply came to Roy Kopp and said, before the first meeting of the board after a merger had taken place, and Bernie Ziegler came to Roy Kopp and he said, let's just agree right now that you'll be president of the newly merged board, and for the first term as president of the newly merged board, and subsequently perhaps the presidency will go back to the a member of the university board, and let's just have a gentleman's agreement that it'll be that way. And it was that way. It could have been a fight, but Bernie Ziegler was a big enough man, and Roy Kopp was such a gentleman and a man of such obvious integrity that I think he felt free to do be the gentleman that he was in doing that, so that that crisis was overcome. And Bernie served for a time, as I recall, as the first vice president of the board. But our troubles were far, far from over. The even the selection of the first committee chairmanships were highly tension-ridden at the time, and there were people on both boards who wanted to be appointed to chairmanships, and Mr. Kopp had a very delicate job on his hands getting that one worked out. And it was, you know, when the board first met, the only person that they could agree on to be presiding officer at that first meeting was Everett Call. Somebody had to preside until they could at least elect officers.
Exactly.
Everett Call was the agreed upon neutral. He was a member, ex officio member of both boards, as state superintendent of instruction, and a very fine person in whom everybody had a lot of confidence. And so he was made the first chairman, or was made the temporary chairman.
Step one, I guess.
Step one, so that they could proceed to get officers elected. And then officers, once elected, then the new president had the job of appointing some committee chairman. It turned out that Roy Kopp had and his wife had arranged a long vacation at sea that just happened to come just at the point where this election took place. Roy Kopp was elected the first president of the board, and the very next day, as I remember it, he and Mrs. Kopp took off on a trip to the Mediterranean. And this was a mighty interesting thing, because first thing you knew, there was all kinds of telephoning across the Atlantic to Roy Kopp about what had he in fact promised to who, and tensions ran very high. Surprisingly so, as you look back on it, hard to believe that people would have been so suspicious of one another as they were in those days, but You may be surprised at my saying this, but as I sit here looking at the pictures of some of my very dear friends who were president of the University of Wisconsin Foundation in those formative years, I'd like to say that I think the fact that the University Foundation supported Mrs. Weaver and me with funds for entertaining, that made it possible for Mrs. Weaver and me to use 130 North Prospect as a scene of a considerable amount of social activity in those days, had more to do with getting us over some of the original and difficult bumps than would have otherwise at all been possible.
How so?
Almost immediately when the new board first met, we had the first board really was a combination of the two boards put together in a very large board and very unwieldy board in terms of size, which complicated the tensions and the problems of merger. In the first place, you had two boards put together, each suspicious of the other and almost evenly divided. Then you had people who really didn't know each other, but they had lots of suspicions of one another and the motivations of one another. And as I perceived it, one of the quickest ways to try to resolve some of the existing tensions and problems between them was to get them acquainted. It's much harder to be suspicious of and mad at somebody you know and can talk with in an informal way than it is to be suspicious and feisty about somebody that's a stranger.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So we had that board out at our house for dinner on the Thursday night preceding their first board meeting.
Both boards?
Yes. And well, now I guess it probably wasn't both boards before their first meeting, because I hadn't been elected president until that meeting was over. It must have been the first meeting they had after that, when I was officially the president of the system. Ms. Weaver and I had the whole, let's see, what was it? It was a 21 or 22 board group at that point, out at the house for cocktails and dinner in the evening. And it was a pleasant social occasion. We tried to make it as relaxed and convivial as we could. I think we made some ground at that dinner party in getting people acquainted. We had them out at the house month after month, every board meeting. We had a dinner at the house. They began to get acquainted. They began to become friends. The tensions began to lessen. Now, as I say, that's a sort of a different dimension to the life of a president of a university or of a university system, but human relations is at the very heart of success in the presidency. You've got to have the team around you, whether it's board members or administrative staff members or faculty members or whatever it is. They've got to be people who begin to build confidence in themselves and in themselves as a group. And I think the president has and his wife both have a tremendously important job to perform in just plain human relations and in the creation of good human relations. The establishment of mutual trust and confidence. And a lot of that can best be done in a social situation, completely outside the business affairs of the board or of the university. And we tried to use that as effectively as we possibly could. Fortunately, we had a lot of people of goodwill involved. And that helped a lot. The members of that original Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin board, the board that hired me, were a very fine group of men and one lady. People like Gordon Walker, Bernard Ziegler, Walter Rank, Dr. Jim Nellen, Mrs. Kerr Sandin, Pelosek, Fish, Gillette, Dahlstrom, and certainly Mr. Call, who was the ex officio member, as state superintendent, were all of the men of goodwill, men of very sincere interest in the university and the betterment of higher education in this state. And they did a lot of bending and a lot of accommodating. And so did people on that state university board, like Roy Kopp, who is a consummate compromiser, a lovely human being who simply could not tolerate conflict and who worked overtime trying to get people to work with one another. People like Jim Solberg from Menominee, these were people that were very quickly aware of the fact. I think of John Dixon from Appleton, people who were very quickly aware of the fact that this had to work, and they had to live together, and they had to work effectively together. And I worked with them on the phone. I went to see them in their own home grounds. We entertained them as a group when they were here. I tried to match up groups of them from both sides of the old board in various kinds of commitments and jobs. You know, by the end of the first year, you began to lose track of the old dividing line.
Did you really? That soon?
And it was, I think the most important contribution I was able to make to merger, or certainly one of the most important, was the contribution I believe I was able to make to bringing those board members together into a reasonably cohesive whole with a general basic willingness to work together for a common cause. I had a very comparable problem to work on with the chancellors. The 15 chancellors of the 15 major units of the system, the 13 degree granting universities plus extension and the center system. Man, were they suspicious when we first when I first tried to get them together. Mutual suspicion. Tension-ridden beyond your belief. When I congregated the first meeting of the 15 chancellors in the regent room on the 18th floor of Van Nuys Hall, you can't believe how tense a group of men that was.
What were the bases?
Everybody worrying about who was going to get a short end of what deal. And was the president really going to let these chancellors, who in the case of the state universities had lost the title president and been made chancellors, were they really going to have enough autonomy to run their institutions, or were they going to be told what to do at every turn in the road? And were their special needs going to get reasonable consideration? Were they going to have a chance to talk to the board themselves, or was I going to stand between them and the board on every issue? And just a whole host of, change always frightens people.
True.
And this was radical change. A lot of those chancellors had never even met me. They didn't know what I might do to them. There was a great, among the state university chancellors, there were many of them who were terribly afraid that this president, who really was the president of the university, had been the president of the University of Wisconsin, was going to put a repressive hand on them and see to it that Madison got everything and they got nothing. And you just can't imagine all the imagined concerns that they had. But I think when we sat down at that regent table as a group of 15 chancellors that day in the regent room, I called them together to start the conversations that were going to have to become more and more frequent and more in depth over the next months and years. I had trouble that morning getting them to agree on the time of day. Mm-hmm. It was I discovered that morning just before we met that the state university chancellors had met as a group at breakfast before this meeting to sort of gird their loins for the battle.
Oh, present a solid core, huh?
present a solid front. And we worked at that very hard. And slowly but surely, that too shook down into a good team.
What do you think?
I replaced some of the chancellors, not because of the matters of tension over these things, but there were some that we felt we could replace with stronger people, or there were illnesses and some people fell by the wayside in one way and another, but so the team changed a little as the years went along, but
I know Chancellor Wiley at Parkside died.
We lost him by death, and we lost one or two by retirement, and one or two that frankly I asked to resign, although it was never publicly known that they were asked to do so.
Would you say who they were?
I really asked Chancellor Carter at Whitewater to retire and go back to teaching, because I felt he was not giving strong leadership to that campus. I encouraged early retirement on the part of Chancellor Olsvik at Platteville, a man who I just very fond of personally, a lovely human being. but he just was not giving really strong leadership to the, it seemed to me, to the modernization of reality at Plantville. I encouraged early retirement on the part of Roger Giles at Oshkosh, because I felt he had really given the best leadership he could to Oshkosh, and we needed new blood in that situation. Very early on, I replaced the chancellor at Stout because of illness on the part of the man who had been chancellor up there. The first chancellor I appointed actually was Robert Swanson at Stout, simply because his predecessor had to retire because of ill health. But slowly but surely, that chancellor team resolved itself into a, and it was the, we had as a secretary of our group, Eugene Lee, who works in the, is a professor in the Institute for the Studies of Higher Education at the University of California at Berkeley. A very knowledgeable young man who has written two books in the Carnegie series on system administration, and who sort of followed us as his case examples. That group said to me many, many times, with obvious sincerity, not hollow flattery, that they got to know Don Smith and Don Percy and many of the other members of our administrative team. And there was just a general consensus that this Wisconsin team was the best system administration in the country. And I don't say that to brag about myself. I say it to express the great gratitude I have for those people who really have done an outstanding job and are nationally recognized for it. And I think that should be on the record. It's not hollow flattery, it's an honest fact. And I know a lot of tough-headed people in American higher education who aren't given to making flattering remarks, but who just are, there's just no limit to the expression of their admiration for people like Smith and Percy and the staffs they have put together under them and the team that has been evolved here.
This raises a question in my mind which I hadn't earlier thought of particularly. But I get the feeling that this kind of system may in fact have evolved somewhat differently in a different direction from some of the others. Is that true?
Yes, I think it is true. I think every state's unique. And every state system is in one way or another uniquely adapted to the circumstances of its state. Actually, there's only one other state that has what I would call the heterogeneous kind of system that we have here in Wisconsin.
What do you mean by that?
A heterogeneous system I would define as one that is composed of institutions of a variety of kinds, ranging from former state teachers' colleges and state colleges to a distinguished comprehensive land-grant AAU-type university such as Madison, and an urban university, or comparatively new, in Milwaukee, And specialized institutions like Green Bay and Stout all working together in a coordinated common effort in higher education in the same system, as compared to, say, the University of California, which is a system of 9 campuses, but they're all 9 institutions that are basically of the same general academic mold and the same general academic aspiration and function. UCLA and Berkeley are, to be sure, far more comprehensive than any of the other campuses in the system, but Davis and Santa Barbara and the other campuses of the University of California are all of a common aspiration and mold, and basically the same kind of functions are being served at a common quality level. And research and graduate education is a part of it in all of them, which is quite different from a system that will range anywhere from Superior and River Falls to a Madison.
Mm-hmm. 9 versus 27, too.
That's right. It's quite right. And the state, the University of Missouri, is really basically a 4-campus university, and the 4 campuses are in many ways quite different, but they're all part of the University of Missouri. It's not the University of Missouri system. It's the University of Missouri, just like it's the University of California. And the same is true in Texas. The same is true at Illinois. Now down in North Carolina, you find one other example that is the closest to being like Wisconsin, where North Carolina put all of their public higher educational institutions together in a single system. And they've got everything from black land-grant colleges to former state teachers' colleges to the North Carolina State University at Raleigh, which is really the land-grant institution, to what is probably the best university in the southeast at Chapel Hill. And that's a heterogeneous system. In a way, the State University of New York is heterogeneous. It's everything from 2-year colleges to former state teachers' colleges to some new universities. I guess the important thing is that, as I say, the systems really are as different as the states they represent. No two of them are really all alike. But if I had to identify the system that comes closest to being like ours, and even it, of course, is very different from Wisconsin, would be the University of North Carolina, because it's the same kind of complete collection of all the higher education of the state in one system, all the public higher education. In California, you see, the University of California is a 9-campus, multi-campus university system. But on top of that, California's got a state college system, which has got about 50 state colleges in it, and then in addition to that, there's an enormous junior college system. And the 3 of them are not together.
Unmerged.
And if they ever merged all that together in one piece, it would really be so big no one would ever be able to see all parts of it in a lifetime.
I guess.
I should certainly say for the record that I think that I've been blessed with, through my years in the system, with some really outstanding vice presidential help. At the beginning, Leonard Haas, who had been chancellor of, or president of the State University at Eau Claire, and had been rather quickly brought, as Eugene McPhee, the longtime standing executive director of the State College or State University system, was coming to retirement. Rather quickly, Leonard Haas was brought in the summer of 40, the summer of 71, to be the new executive director, even though merger was bearing down very close to us. He was a good choice.
There was criticism of him as a choice.
He was and is probably not a person who would have been elected by a Madison faculty group to a vice presidency of the University of Madison. But Leonard Haas was a very important cog in the early days of merger, because he represented, and everybody in the state university system had confidence in him. He had the confidence of those regents, he had the confidence of those chancellors, and of the people generally of that system. And since I was perceived as being a University of Wisconsin man, there just had to be somebody who could represent the confidence of that other side of this newly melded thing. And Len Haas was that. And there should have been no criticism of him, because Leonard Haas is one of the finest people that ever walked the earth. He is integrity personified. He's a team man from the word go. And he served a terribly important function in helping me bring these two groups together. He was loyal to me and to the success of that system beyond anybody's belief. I came to think the world of him as a personal friend, as well as have enormous respect for the contribution he made to making the early days of merger, which were very bumpy, come together. As the merger finally got further down the road, Len showed more and more evidence of not being particularly happy in the sort of detached realm of system administration. He began to show his longing for getting back to a campus, which was very understandable to me, because, you know, indeed the kind of a job that I wound up in really becomes more, in many ways, more politics than education. And Len began to show more and more interest in returning to his own campus and going back to his duties as chancellor at Eau Claire, which is a very fine, smaller institution, getting closer back to the educational life. And after a couple of years, the need we had had for him to help in the melding process began to diminish, partly because he'd done very well in the process of helping with the melding. And I guess it was the end of his second year, at his request, I backed his request to be allowed to return to Eau Claire, where he is clearly one of the very best chancellors in the system, and where he's much happier, really, than he was in system administration. And he and I remain very close personal friends, and with a mutual sense of admiration, and I can only say that he performed a great service to the putting of the system together in the very difficult circumstances that we were confronted with early on. But in the long pull, I also want to say that I think Don Percy and a bit later Don Smith performed enormously important functions as my two senior vice presidents. Don Percy is an extremely bright, extremely intelligent, very active, hardworking person who brought real brilliance to bear on the developing of statewide data systems and the management of a very large and very complex budget and certain other administrative affairs as a senior vice president for administration. And I was very fortunate indeed in being able to persuade my old friend Donald Smith, who was the number two man in the administration at the University of Minnesota, to come home to Wisconsin, where he got his own PhD as our senior vice president for academic affairs, an appointment that was backed by a search and screen committee in the first instance. And Don Smith and Don Percy worked, I often have said that one of the great fortunes of my administration was that I had two vice presidents that were as strong and as capable as those two. And they worked together without a wrinkle. I never once in, must have been close to 6 years that I had the two of them as senior vice presidents, I never once saw any sign of tension between those two men.
That's remarkable.
Which is almost unbelievable when you've got two people that strong and that capable. And both of them have had a very influential hand in the development of many phases of the ways and means by which the system actually functions. Both of them had the ability to gain the full confidence of the chancellors, and I think were widely respected by the regents, among the regents. And they have played an enormously important role. I delegated a wide range of authorities to both of them, had full confidence in them, and I never had any reason to regret the authority that I gave them, because they're just top-notch in every way. And I can say that it's true that as I have many very close friends among the top people in higher education across the country, and one group that I met with regularly that was of great usefulness and helpfulness to me was a group of chief executive officers of systems in other states. This included the heads of the University of Texas system, University of California, University of Illinois, University of Missouri, the State University of New York, University of North Carolina. Did I mention Illinois? We met about, well, we met regularly, twice a year, once in the late fall and once in the early summer, to discuss the mutual problems of the management of systems, which are sort of unique as higher educational administrative affairs go. And it was the, we had as a secretary of our group, Eugene Lee, who works in the, is a professor in the Institute for the Studies of Higher Education at the University of California at Berkeley. A very knowledgeable young man who has written two books in the Carnegie series on system administration, and who sort of followed us as his case examples. That group said to me many, many times, with obvious sincerity, not hollow flattery, that they got to know they got to know Don Smith and Don Percy and many of the other members of our administrative team. And there was just a general consensus that this Wisconsin team was the best system administration in the country. And I don't say that to brag about myself. I say it to express the great gratitude I have for those people who really have done an outstanding job and are nationally recognized for it. And I think that should be on the record. It's not hollow flattery, it's an honest fact. And I know a lot of tough-headed people in American higher education who aren't given to making flattering remarks, but who just are, there's just no limit to the expression of their admiration for people like Smith and Percy and the staffs they have put together under them and the team that has been evolved here.
This raises a question in my mind which I hadn't earlier thought of particularly, but I get the feeling that this kind of system may in fact have evolved somewhat differently in a different direction from some of the others. Is that true?
Yes, I think it is true. I think every state's unique, and every state system is in one way or another uniquely adapted to the circumstances of its state. Actually, there's only one other state that has what I would call the heterogeneous kind of system that we have here in Wisconsin.
What do you mean by that?
A heterogeneous system I would define as one that is composed of institutions of a variety of kinds, ranging from former state teachers' colleges and state colleges to a distinguished comprehensive land-grant AAU-type university such as Madison, and an new urban university, or comparatively new, in Milwaukee, and specialized institutions like Green Bay and Stout, all working together in a coordinated, common effort in higher education in the same system, as compared to, say, the University of California, which is a system of 9 campuses, but they're all 9 institutions that are basically of the same general academic mold and the same general academic aspiration and function. UCLA and Berkeley are, to be sure, far more comprehensive than any of the other campuses in the system, but Davis and Santa Barbara and the other campuses of the University of California are all of a common aspiration and mold, and basically the same kind of functions are being served at a common quality level. And research and graduate education is a part of it in all of them, which is quite different from a system that will range anywhere from Superior and River Falls to a Madison. Mm-hmm.
9 versus 27, too.
That's right.
Have an effect.
It's quite right. And the state, the University of Missouri is really basically a four-campus university, and the four campuses are in many ways quite different, but they're all part of the University of Missouri. It's not the University of Missouri system. It's the University of Missouri, just like it's the University of California. And the same is true in Texas. The same is true at Illinois. Now, down in North Carolina, you find one other example that is the closest to being like Wisconsin, where North Carolina put all of their public higher educational institutions together in a single system. And they've got everything from black land-grant colleges to former state teachers' colleges to the North Carolina State University at Raleigh, which is really the land-grant institution, to what is probably the best university in the Southeast at Chapel Hill. And that's a heterogeneous system. In a way, the State University of New York is heterogeneous. It's everything from two-year colleges to former state teachers' colleges to some new universities. I guess the important thing is that, as I say, the systems really are as different as the states they represent. No two of them are really all alike. But if I had to identify the system that comes closest to being like ours, and even it, of course, is very different from Wisconsin, would be the University of North Carolina, because it's the same kind of complete collection of all the higher education of the state in one system, all the public higher education. In California, you see, the University of California is a 9-campus, multi-campus university system. But on top of that, California's got a state college system, which has got about 50 state colleges in it, and then in addition to that, there's an enormous junior college system. And the three of them are not together.
Unmerged.
And if they ever merged all that together in one piece, it would really be so big no one would ever be able to see all parts of it in a lifetime.
I guess.